And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, we live in interesting times when fears of pandemics are running rampant. World Health Organization has just increased the percentage chance that the current infections are going to become a worldwide pandemic to 40%. That's certainly interesting. Makes me wonder what's going on. I got another book from I think Simon & Schuster sent it to me. It's Inner Traditions Bear Company. And it's The Last Refuge of the Knights Templar. It's modern-day thriller centered on the Templar secrets found in some 19th century letters written by former Confederate General Albert Pike. It does raise many, many questions that may well have answers that would clear up a lot of historical mysteries. Now, we've also got a number of pieces of information. They arrive hit and miss about Area 51. Now, there have been a number of allegations that even journalist Dorothy Kilgallen, who was star with on the TV show What's My Line back in the 50s, wrote about UFOs. In fact, a British official is supposed to have told her, we believe on the basis of our inquiry thus far, that flying saucers are manned by little men, probably under 4 feet tall. And it's frightening, but there's no denying the flying saucers come from another planet. When you start talking about UFOs and Area 51 and some of the personalities involved, you get off into the weeds, so to speak. And one of those interesting aspects are documents that were in the possession of a man named Spiriglio, who actually had copies of documents regarding Marilyn Monroe and Dorothy Kilgallen. Now, most of the contents of the documents and what was later released by the FBI under a FOIA request had to do with conversations between Dorothy Kilgallen and a friend of hers named Howard Rothberg. Now, everybody in the 50s knew Dorothy Kilgallen. In fact, she is the only, as far as I can find out, journalist allowed to have an unsupervised interview with Lee Harvey Oswald. And in later, her murder was very mysterious, hadn't been solved to this day. When the FBI released their information, now the CIA, who was requested under FOIA to release information on Kilgallen, only had a few pages. The FBI had over 170. So that showed she was somebody that J. Edgar Hoover's boys were very much interested in. Now, this also has come to light recently that there's a lot of criminal activity can be laid at the doorstep of the FBI. Lori Loughlin, the actress who was on Hallmark Channel, who lost her career because of an alleged bribe paid to get her daughter in college. The main witness against her says he was forced to admit he told her he had the money was going to him as a bribe, when in fact that may not have been the case. If she didn't know it was a bribe, then she did nothing wrong. If he told her it was a bribe, then arguably she could face charges. But if she doesn't face charges, and the FBI has wasted its time and efforts on a case that's not going to go anywhere. Okay, well, in looking at all the material that has come to light, clearly there's another story that we, the American people, have never been given. And one version of that story was transmitted on British TV station Anglia, June 20th, 1977. The program was entitled Alternative 3. Tim Britton, trusted by millions of viewers nationwide, presented an unexpectedly startling program which announced the approaching end of all life on this planet. According to what he said, now this was a science program. Our world was doomed because of a phenomena which at the time only a forward-thinking minority could imagine. Now, that phenomena is today called climate change. And people are tearing their hair and screaming and marching in the streets and declaring war on climate change, when in actuality, it seems to be a naturally occurring phenomena. Even hardened skeptics such as former President George W. Bush have made mention of it. A nightmare scenario involving polluted atmosphere and cities drowning as the water levels raise. That does bring to light the idea of a world gone mad, so to speak. President Obama had to jump on the bandwagon, went to Paris and talked about the climate change threat. The Paris Climate Conference, which of course we were expected to fund all the efforts to defeat climate change. Well, certain people, as Bezos said, who owns Amazon, the elite have to have more of a say about who gets elected than the peons. After all, they know better. And according to the elite, this world has to be abandoned. Life had to be salvaged by evacuating a nucleus of suitable people to live and breed on other planets, such as Mars. And as the program showed, the feasibility of this planet had already been established by cooperation between the U.S. and Russia. Well, now, Alternative 3 was not broadcast in America or Russia, the countries primarily involved, and most likely it would have been banned on political orders. But it did air in countries such as Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. Now, soon after the transmission, spin doctors, under pressure from governmental-level individuals, tried unsuccessfully to quell the uproar by claiming it had all been a hoax. They said Alternative 3 was intended to be broadcast April 1st as a bit of fun. So it got broadcast in June? Well, a Fleet Street journalist named Leslie Watkins got involved. And his first question, if this is a hoax, why was it broadcast June 20th, 7 weeks after April Fool's Day? So he dug deeper. And what he found resulted in a a book called Alternative 3. And it exposed the full truth and sparked international outrage. And he was attacked as being a scaremongering fantasist. Of course, it has to be conceded his findings did seem almost too incredible to be believed, but we're going to put him out there and see what you think. An American author named Jim Keith, who's normally rather believable in his books, he wrote two books to prove that he was smarter than everybody else. First was Mind Control and UFOs, Casebook Alternative 3. And he clearly believed that this whole thing was made up. And it's hardly surprising that he took that position, or the fact he wasn't alone in his opinion. Even today, some of the facts put out in Alternative 3 strike some people as just too bizarre to be believed. For instance, the concept of scientists and renowned experts, described by the scheme's operators as designated movers, living on Mars after mysteriously disappearing from this world, could raise a lot of questions in people's minds. Yet, it is a fact. A lot of scientists and experts are vanishing regularly without any explanation. One typical example was Japanese psychiatrist Atsumi Yoshikubo, who was 45. She was visiting Canada, happy, healthy, disappeared at Yellowknife October 27th, 2014. On July 23rd, 2015, CBC News reported she was still being sought by search and rescue teams. Now, the city where she vanished only had a population of under 20,000. They could have gone door to door and looked at every person in the country, in the city. But they couldn't find her. Another fact that which disturbed doubters, such as Keith, relates to what the scheme's planners called batch consignments. Now, these are groups of people brainwashed after being kidnapped in order to serve as slaves for the designated movers. Now, of course, immediately you're going to scream, "That's impossible, no slaves, yada, 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 yada." Well, let's check the official statistics. In the year 2010, 692,941 people were reported missing in the USA alone. Just this country. 531,928 were under the age of 18. And if any were destined to go to Mars, catching them young would make sense. The extra working years they had ahead of them more than justified the cost of getting them in the right condition to go to Mars. So by 2013, the total official USA figure for the past 12 months had gone over 900,000. In August 2013, the International Rewards Center, which helps desperate families seeking missing members, reported that 4,432,880 people had vanished in the previous 20 years. 4.5 million people. That's the entire population of a country like New Zealand had just vanished. And this country. There was another thing that was talked about in the book. Spontaneous combustion. Now, any logical person would take the position that is total rubbish. Scientifically impossible. Myths accepted only by the gullible. But there have been more than 200 instances of people burning to death that way that have been reported over the past 300 years. And many have been comparatively recent. May 18, 1958, 68-year-old woman named Anna Martin of West Philadelphia found incinerated. Only her shoes and part of her torso were left. Newspapers less than 3 feet away weren't burnt, though medical experts estimated the temperatures must have gone up to 2,000 degrees to totally do away with her. Then there's Michael Flaherty. December 2010, 76-year-old Irishman was found dead in his Galway home by a neighbor responding to a smoke alarm. At the inquest, which took place in September 2011, it was reported that while his body was burned, the cinders, fire officers were astonished to find nothing else had been damaged apart from the floor below him and a patch of ceiling above him. No sign of any device that could have ignited the body and no instance of foul play. The best that the inquest could come up with was his body appeared to have simply cremated itself. According to the coroner, Dr. Kiernan McLaughlin, this fire was thoroughly investigated and I left with the conclusion that it fits in the category of spontaneous human combustion, for which there is no adequate explanation. Researching scientists, though, present an apparently feasible explanation. They focused on the electricity permanently pulsing through the body of every living creature. Without that electricity, you unwittingly generate, you wouldn't be able to pick up a book, a phone. Your brain's instructions to your hands are delivered by your own electricity. I mean, that's how an EEG works. The brain generates electricity. Information about what's before your eyes is conveyed similarly to your brain. Even your heartbeat relies on that electricity. But in rare cases, it's believed a fault may cause an overproduction of electricity or even a short circuit. This could ignite gases in the body, which in turn could ignite the body bodily fat. And the body will then be burning inside before exploding and being totally destroyed by the fire. Well, the frighteningly erratic behavior of the climate over the last 10, 15 years, and the continuing pollution and despoliation of planet Earth by overpopulation and industry, and the mounting evidence of unexplained disappearances of people in mysterious circumstances, the horrendous new killing techniques, including spontaneous combustion, used by government assassins against those that pose a threat to the security of whatever organization that they're assigned to. All these things are real. They're out there. But the media is so focused on attacking President Trump, they can't look at anything else. Now, these and many other sinister features were examined in Alternative 3. And they're the strands in a web of conspiracy that can only exist in our age of terminal technology. You know, no newspaper has yet secured the truth behind what's become known as Alternative 3. Investigations by journalists, and there have been a number of them, by governments, have been blocked by governments on both sides of the Iron Curtain. America and Russia both are obsessed with guarding their shared secret, and this obsession has made them partners in murder. Despite this, the scrutiny that has resulted in not the mainstream media, because they've got Trump derangement syndrome, but the non-mainstream media, has resulted in certain fragments of information being made public. Sometimes they're released inadvertently by experts who don't appreciate their significance. And these fragments in isolation don't mean a lot. But when you put them together to form a pattern, then clearly there is a conspiracy. May 3rd, 1977, a Daily Mirror published an interesting story. They said President Jimmy Carter, the man who was attacked by the killer rabbit, has joined the ranks of UFO spotters. He sent in two written reports saying he'd seen a flying saucer when he was governor in Georgia. Well, the president shrugged off the incident since then, fearing electors might be wary of a flying saucer freak. But he was reported as saying after the sighting, "I don't laugh at people anymore when they say they've seen them because I've seen one." He said it was luminous, not solid, at first bluish, then reddish, and seemed to move toward us from a distance, to stop and move partially away. Well, that, in the eyes of many, made him open-minded. But during his presidential campaign, he was viewed as cautious. He admitted he'd seen a light in the sky, but declined to call it a UFO. He said, "I think it was a light beckoning me to run in a California primary election," which means something changed his view of the world. And many believe it's because he'd been briefed on the Alternative 3 program. Whatever the government may call it internally, this necessity of abandoning the Earth and colonizing the other planets, and as we talked about the last couple of nights, it is quite feasible that life could exist on the other planets. A 1966 Gallup poll showed that 5 million Americans, including a number of airline pilots, claimed to have seen flying saucers. Fighter pilot, and he was not a novice, he was an expert. Thomas Mantell died chasing one over Kentucky. His F-51 literally disintegrated in the violent wash of his quarry's engines. The U.S. Air Force finally asked Dr. Edward Condon, a professor of astrophysics, to head an investigation team at Colorado University. Gave him $500,000 to do it. Well, he issued a report in 1968. That report denied. The report totaled 1,485 pages, but it denied the existence of flying saucers. And the American National Academy of Science endorsed the conclusion that further extensive study probably can't be justified. So if nothing else, that put the end to formal government investigations, at least as far as the public knew. But Condon's joint principal investigator, Dr. David Saunders, hadn't contributed a word to that report. Now, there's been a lot of suspicion that the report was part of an official cover-up. The government knew the truth, but was determined to keep it from the public. We know from the Robertson panel in the 50s that it was recommended that everything be done to stifle the investigation of UFOs as spacecraft from outer space. Only a few months after Dr. Saunders was quoted as saying it's inconceivable that it can be anything but a cold stew, no matter how long it is, what it concludes, how it's said, or what it recommends, Condon's report lacks the essential element of credibility. And a few months after that, a journalist with the Columbus Dispatch embarrassed the NASA by photographing a strange craft that looked like a flying saucer at the White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico. Now, at first, nobody at NASA would talk about this mysterious craft. 15 feet in diameter, had been left in the missile graveyard, a section of the range where most experimental vehicles were eventually dumped. But Martin Marietta Company out of Denver, where that craft was built, acknowledged designing several models, some with 10 and 12 engines. And a NASA official faced with this information finally said, actually, the engineers used to call it the flying saucer. And that confirmed a statement made by Dr. Gary Henderson, a leading space research scientist, who said all our astronauts have seen these objects, but have been ordered not to discuss their findings with anybody. And then, of course, it's basically an open secret that NASA killed significant segments of conversation on mission control in Apollo 11. And those segments were deleted from the official record. Well, Bob Groden, another of the Apollo moonwalkers, was specific when interviewed by Scepter TV on June 20th, 1977. He said, you think they need all that crap down in Florida to put two guys up there on a bicycle? You know why they need us? So they've got a PR story for all the hardware they've been firing into space. In other words, that was a tacit admission there is a secret space program. Well, that raises so many questions, sometimes you don't even know where to start. What exactly is going on, and why won't our government tell us? You know, it's intriguing to note the pattern of facts relating to astronauts who've been on the missions, the moon missions, and been exposed to some of the surprises presented by Alternative 3. A number undermined by the strain of being party to these secrets suffered nervous and mental collapses. A high percentage thought sanctuary and excessive drinking or extramarital affairs would destroy what had been secure and successful marriages. But these were the men picked from many thousands precisely because they were so stable. Their training and experience, intelligence, physical fitness, certainly these were considerations, but the most important quality for which they were chosen was their balanced temperament. It would take something stupendous, almost unimaginable, to flip such men into dramatic personality changes. But that happened to most of them. Well, it raises so many questions. Now, if Alternative 3 exists, as we've been led to believe that it does, then it becomes of paramount importance to determine to what lengths would the government go to keep it quiet. According to the information that has come to light, the determination that people be, well, it used to be called executive action, folks be assassinated, is actually called acts of expediency. There are said to be 16 men, official representatives of the Pentagon and the Kremlin, who comprised the policy committee, and a number of grotesque and apparently inexplicable killings in various parts of the world, Germany, Japan, Britain, Australia, are alleged to have been sanctioned by this policy committee. There was, now, of course, there is no proof that would stand up in court because these are actually similar to the Kennedy assassination. Allegedly, unconnected, uncontrolled events. An unknown number of people, to include a distinguished radio astronomer, Sir William Ballantyne, have been executed because of this agreement between the superpowers. Now, prominent politicians, including two in Britain, were among those who tried to prevent the publication of the book Alternative 3. They insisted it's not necessary for the public to be told the facts. They argue that the events of the future are now inevitable. There's nothing to be gained by prematurely unleashing fear. Now, they may well be sincere in their views, but that does not mean the public doesn't have a right to know. After all, it's your money paying for it. And attempts were also made to gut the television program that first focused public attention on Alternative 3. And those attempts were actually somewhat successful. And of course, after the program was transmitted, Scepter TV was forced to issue a formal denial. They had to go in front of everybody and say it all been a hoax. If you want to be licensed to continue to broadcast. Now, most people were very happy to be reassured that everything they'd been told wasn't true. They wanted to be convinced the program had been devised as a joke. It was an elaborate piece of entertainment. That way they could go back to their fish and chips and beer and popcorn and football. In fact, the television researchers uncovered far more disturbing material than they were allowed to transmit. They didn't know, for example, that Sir William Ballantyne's unusual death, not far from his base at Jodrell Bank, which was mirrored by that of an aerospace professor by the name of Peterson near Stanford University at Palo Alto, California. Nor did they know about the monthly conferences of the committee. Now, alternative three on the face appears a preposterous concept until you analyze the history of the so-called space race. Right from the start, the public have been allowed to know only what's considered appropriate for them to know. Many futuristic research developments and the extent of information pool between East and West were kept highly classified. Now, there was a small but typical example in 1951 when living creatures were hurtled into the stratosphere for the very first time. Or at least the public was told about it for the first time. Four monkeys, called Albert 1, 2, 3, and 4, launched in a V-2 rocket, made by the Nazis, of course, from White Sands, New Mexico. Now, the monkeys were successfully brought back to Earth. Three survived, one died of heat stroke. Much later, when news leaked out, it was explained that Operation Albert had been kept secret for one reason: to avert any possibility of animal lovers staging a protest demonstration. Now, a lot of people accepted that story, that the four monkeys really had been the world's first travelers in space. But the question was that a true statement? By 1951, the V-2 rocket, which was a relic of World War II, had been superseded by far more sophisticated missiles. So would it be logical or indeed practical to use an obsolete vehicle for the first launch of living creatures into space? It'd be far more feasible to argue that Operation Albert was no more than a subsidiary experiment which happened to slip through the security net, that the authorities were not too perturbed about having to confirm it because it helped conceal the real and gigantic truth. Now, there is abundant evidence that by 1951, the superpowers are far more advanced in space technology than they've ever been willing to admit. Much of that evidence has been supplied by experienced pilots, like Captain Lawrence Vintner. At 8:30 p.m. on January 20th, 1951, Captain Vintner, then a Mid-Continent Airlines, was ordered by the controller at Sioux City Airport to investigate a very bright light above the field. He and his co-pilot, James Backmeyer, took off in a DC-3 and headed for the source. Suddenly, the light dived toward him at great speed and passed about 200 feet above him. Then they discovered it had a reverse direction, apparently in a split second, was firing parallel to the airliner. Now, it was a clear moonlit night, and both men saw that the light was coming from a cigar-shaped object bigger than a B-29. And that's a good-size vehicle. Eventually, the strange craft lost altitude and passed under the DC-3 and vanished. 2 months later, March 15th, thousands of people in New Delhi were startled by a strange light high in the sky that appeared to be circling the city. One witness was George Franklin Float, chief engineer with the Delhi Flying Club, who described a bullet-nosed, cigar-shaped object about 100 feet long with a ring of flames at the end. Two Indian Air Force jets were sent up to intercept the craft, but the object surged upward at a phenomenal speed and vanished. So despite all official denials, there had been quite a number of advances made by 1951 that nobody was talking about. By the mid-70s, there were so many rumors about covert information swapping between East and West that the American-Russian rivals staged a masterpiece of camouflage. they decided to show the world quite openly how they were prepared to cooperate in space. The result was seen in July of 1975, the first admitted international space transfer. Television camera showed the docking of a Soyuz spacecraft with an Apollo and the crew's jubilee is changing food and symbolic halves of medals. Leonard Brezhnev sent a message to the United Spacemen. Your successful docking confirms the correctness of technical solutions that were worked out and realized in cooperation by Soviet and American scientists, designers, and cosmonauts. One can say that Soyuz Apollo is a prototype for future international orbital stations. And Gerald Ford expressed the hope this tremendous demonstration of cooperation will set the pattern for what we have to do in the future to make it a better world. Well, there'd been no television coverage. Now, this story came from Bob Groden, former Apollo astronaut. There'd been no television coverage, no glory of any sort when he had done the identical maneuver 140 miles above the clouds on April 20th, 1969. He had shaken hands with the Russians and laughed at their bad jokes, exactly like Tom Stafford had been doing. But there'd been no celebrity crap. In fact, the American-Russian docking technique was actually pioneered in the late 50s with specially designed submarines in the depths of the North Atlantic. It was pioneered specifically because of Alternative 3, because of the need for ultimate insecurity. The system made it possible for men who were officially enemies who played the charade of distrusting each other in public to travel separately and discreetly to meetings that took place far beneath the surface of the ocean. Now, the Thursday, February 3rd, 1977, one of the policy committee meetings was infiltrated by a double agent. It took place in the wardroom of a modified Permit nuclear sub, 35 fathoms, and a fathom is 6 feet, beneath the ice of the Arctic. Now, Permit subs are designed to seek out and destroy the enemy. At least that's what the American taxpayers are told. There are no names on the transcript. No names are apparently ever used. Only nationalities and numbers, 8 Russians. 8 Americans. What they did at that meeting was determine whether or not to have a potential source of information that they couldn't control killed. And in fact, by the time it was done, they had agreed that there would be 3 murders. No matter what they chose to call them or what the reasons for them might be, they were still talking about murder. Now, a great deal by that time had been written in the Western press about strange experiments being conducted on inmates, chiefly dissidents, and political prisoners at a mental hospital in Ukraine. Now, these experiments were considered barbaric, but they were known about. They, in fact, August 3rd, 1977, the London Evening News talked about what was discussed at this meeting. Human guinea pigs have been used by the CIA in experiments to control behavior and sexual activity. American intelligence agency also considered hiring a magician for another secret program on mind control. The experiments over the past 20 years are revealed in documents that were thought to have been destroyed, which have now been released after pressure from United States Senate and congressional committees. Now, It's interesting to note that when Congress is not fixated, as it has been for the last 4 years, it can actually accomplish quite a lot of good. The problem is getting them to get over their fixation. Now, another story in the Daily Telegraph discussed this in some more detail. Some of the more chilling details, she wrote, of the way the CIA tried to control individual behavior by using drugs on willing and unwilling human guinea pigs were talked about by its director, Mr. Stansfield Turner. Now, Turner was actually an admiral, and he said the tests were important to him, but those tests did take place. He said they were carried out in safe houses in San Francisco and New York, where unwitting sexual psychopaths were subjected to experiments and attempts were made to change sexual conduct and other forms of human behavior. He said at least 185 scientists and 80 research institutions, including universities, were involved. Now, one man, he said, had killed himself by jumping out of a hotel window in New York City. See, when LSD was first being looked at as a way to address human behavior, the CIA thought it was, some of their people thought it was interesting to unknowingly slip it into the drinks of various staff people. It happened at a party in New York City, and the man jumped and died. Eventually, the CIA settled with that family. Now, three people unwittingly inspired the Alternative Three show. And although they would be dismayed to realize it, it was their actions that directly led to this report. Dr. Ann Clark was a research scientist specializing in solar energy. Brian Pendleberry, a former RAF man, was an electronics expert. Robert Patterson was a senior lecturer in mathematics. Or he was until he vanished. Almost certainly he no longer teaches math, but he's working full-time for the Alternative 3 organization. So these three people were, in fact, the catalyst for the entire investigation. Now, Ann Clark was described as a raven-haired, attractive woman, not quite 30, who made her big decision toward the end of 1975. She would never have made it, although her pride stopped her admitting that much on TV if her fiancé had unexpectedly broken their engagement. Up to that point, her future was set. She'd intended to continue on despite all the frustrations at the research lab in Norwich until they got married, and then probably until their first child was born. She said conditions at the lab were not the best, but she was prepared to tolerate them. Well, then her fiancé shattered her dreams. He told her that their engagement had been a mistake. He didn't want to get tied down, and 4 weeks later, she reported he was talking about marrying some girl named Maureen. Suddenly, the lab and everything about it became extremely depressing. All the authorities admitted that their research was important, particularly with the energy shortage and the climbing cost of oil. But apparently it wasn't important enough to have much money put into it. Now, experimental projects often took three times as long as they should because of equipment that was cobbled together and in some cases almost obsolete. And certain projects couldn't even be started. The stock answer they got when they asked for something new was maybe in the next financial year, but there's no budget now. What she wanted was to throw herself harder than ever into her research, but she was increasingly aware, like others, she wasn't being allowed to make full use of her training. Plenty of the others were also looking at making a change at that point in time. They were getting out of Britain, heading for the big money jobs in Europe and the Middle East, and in America especially. They were getting sometimes 2 and 3 times their salaries, getting bonus perks like company cars and big homes. At a minimum, they were getting better working conditions. It was called the brain drain. And it was a fairly accurate label. A little, one more time. In the 12 years up to December 1975, and that was the month Ann Clark reached her decision, nearly 4 million people had left the United Kingdom. And more than a third of them were from the professional managerial level of British society. One of the department heads at Norwich that had left for a top post in America at the beginning of that year, and as his occasional letters had shown, he hadn't regretted a thing. In fact, he regretted he hadn't made the jump years earlier. So she decided to write him. Well, to her amazement, he didn't respond by letter. He called her from California as soon as he got the letter. He said there'd be no problem at all, not with her ability and experience. She was exactly the type they needed, and if she wanted, he'd certainly get it fixed up with the right job. Well, she didn't think it would be that easy, but apparently there was a man in London who was recruiting scientists for the company in California, and she cared to contact the man. Well, she assured her former boss that she'd call him immediately. So he said, I'll get in touch with him and put him in the picture about you. Well, she met the man in London the following day. It was all settled within an hour. She wrote her resignation on a train back to Norwich. Well, that was the week that she was first contacted by Sceptre Television. And at first, she was more than happy to talk with him about her plans. She didn't mention her former fiancé, though, because viewers didn't need to know about that. But it was important for people to be told exactly why scientists were leaving Britain in droves. And she was flattered, in fact, to be given the opportunity and told herself by speaking out she might help get conditions approved for those she was leaving. Well, now comes the mystery, which hasn't been solved yet. The information that I gave you came from Ann Clark's friends and colleagues. Shortly after Sceptre Television Film Unit arrived at the laboratory in January 1976 for the first of the interviews, Ann Clark was visited by a strange American. He made no appointment, just turned up, and they assumed he was connected in some way with her new job. He talked to her privately for a long period of time, and afterwards she seemed upset. She refused later to say what he wanted and what they'd discussed. And that same man went to her apartment that evening and stayed for 3 hours. And after that evening, her attitude to those around her and to the Sceptre TV people changed. She worked as conscientiously as ever, but she was oddly withdrawn. She refused to be drawn into conversations. And there was something else as well. One of her colleagues said, I started noticing she was sometimes looking at me and others with a funny sort of expression in her eyes. It was almost as if, for some reason or other, she felt sorry for us. It was all a bit odd, in his opinion. Well, it was all very odd. She left Norwich in a self-drive hired car, February 22nd, 1976. Left without working out her notice because, as she explained, the Americans were in a hurry to have her. She became part of the brain drain. The problem is, she still hadn't joined that company in California. Nobody knows where she went. Brian Pendlebury was 33 when he became part of the brain drain in July of 74. His principal reason for leaving was he disliked the climate, particularly the climate in Manchester. He was a sun person. Since leaving university with a degree in electronics, he'd acquired a taste for travel as a special projects officer with the RAF. And the RAF, Royal Air Force, that is, had shown him the world. Also shown him he wasn't the type to settle down in a humdrum routine. Certainly not in the drab Coronation Street atmosphere of Manchester. 5 months after leaving the RAF, he applied for a job with a major electronics firm in Sydney, Australia. And to the disappointment of his parents, he got the job. Yeah, they were disappointed for a selfish but very understandable reason. He was their only child, and they adored him. They had scrimped to get him through the university and been so proud over his success. For years, they had seen so very little of him. They had hoped he'd live at home for a year or so, at least. His mother also had this vision of him marrying some nice, sensible Lancashire girl, and she would become a doting grandmother. Well, he used to say, we can work out some compromise. I'll try to find myself some nice, sensible Australian girl, and you can have a grandson with a touch of Aborigine in him. Well, such was his mindset. Once he made up his mind, there was no arguing with him. He did say he'd keep in touch. He'd write and he'd send photos. Well, he kept that promise, kept it for 5 months after leaving Manchester. Every week they got a letter with news of his life in Australia. He said the job was going fine. He was really enjoying himself. They got photographs of him surfing with friends at a nightclub in front of the Sydney Harbour Bridge. Everything was fine except for a few facts that they tried not to look at. See, he didn't live at the address shown on his letters. The company for which he claimed to be working insists they never heard of him. The truth, as far as anybody can establish, is he never got to Australia. Now, Robert Patterson had a problem with the British taxation system. He was 42, a well-known mathematician. His friends at the University of St. Andrews, where he was a senior lecturer, had become accustomed to a regular bombardment of figures from the man. He used to say, do you realize in Germany the most a man has to pay on the top slice of his taxable earnings is only 56%? And in America, it's only 50%? Every one of his sentences when he was talking tax seemed to finish with an exclamation point. He was really on his hobby horse when it came to taxation. And in Britain, he used to say it's 83%. That sort of conversation with him supplying all the questions and the answers could go on indefinitely without anybody else saying a word. It was kind of a leftover part of his lecture room technique, and it made him quite boring, to be perfectly frank. Many people at the university were relieved when he eventually announced he was going to be following his own advice. He and his wife were getting out of Britain, taking their two children off for a fresh start in America. He was unusually reticent about what he was going to do in America, saying no more than he'd been invited to an interesting project. Seemed obvious, despite his evasiveness, he'd accepted some really plum post in America. University wasn't surprised. He was recognized as one of the most brilliant mathematicians in Britain. It was a pity he was also such a jackass. Well, he broke the news the beginning of February 1976, and there was a paragraph about it in The Guardian. And one of the researchers at Scepter TV, who'd organized the initial interview with Ann Clark, saw the paragraph and contacted Peterson. So he called and offered to interview Peterson on their program, Science Report. And didn't go anywhere. Eventually, he agreed to an interview at his home. And when the reporter went to the man's home for the interview, the house was locked and empty. The family had left in a hurry at lunchtime on that same day. Family's car was later found abandoned in London, but the Patterson family hadn't been seen since. Now, February 6, 1977, Sir William Ballantyne was visibly nervous. Those who saw him had no question about that. There was, he had discovered something that had him very upset. It was a, something he had recorded at the Jodrell Bank radio, from the telescope. And he knew he should have gone public months before with what was really happening in space. And he should have done it the same day, he thought, when he went to NASA headquarters in the U.S. and saw a proof man had achieved the impossible. You see, he saw the same video that I did, that we landed on Mars in 1963. We're going to be talking more in the future about Alternative 3. There's a lot of material that has come to light since that program aired, that show that there's a lot we're not being told about. And if we got 4.5 million people that have vanished over the last 20 years, it does. That's just in America. That raises a lot of questions, questions to which we will never actually have the answers. If, in fact, the scenario laid out in Alternative 3 is anywhere close to accurate, we live in a very strange world. Now, Ballantyne died. According to the headlines, Freak Skid kills science chief. There was no explanation for his car careening off the road on the drive to London. He was a competent, steady driver who had traveled that route often before. And even if he was agitated, he would have still made the trip safely. And only one photograph of the crash was made available to the press. Now, an agency cameraman had taken a whole series, but only one had ever been released. Showed part of the wreckage in a blanket-covered shape on a stretcher. The cameraman, whose name was George Green, said they'd all been confiscated, and he was ordered to keep his mouth shut. And there's evidence that people who were at the inquest lied. Now, one of those who lied was Professor Hubert Radwell, the pathologist who gave evidence at the Ballantyne inquest. He reported the body had been extensively burned, but there hadn't been a fire, and nobody cross-examined Radwell. Well, it's been an interesting show. We will have more information on Monday about Alternative 3 and settlements on Mars and all kinds of things. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great weekend.